The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Right, documentary time on this week's socially distanced sports bar. Happy Friday if you listen on Fridays to the free version of the podcast. If you would like to get involved in getting it into your inbox on Tuesdays rather than the Wednesday-Friday combo you got at the moment, then head to patreon.com/distantpod. Mike Bubbins, it is your documentary.
I love this doc. I absolutely love this documentary. This is on the NFL Films YouTube channel. It's also on Game Pass, if you've got Game Pass. It is a series that NFL Films make called A Football Life, and this one is about Franco Harris.
50 years ago, the greatest play in NFL history took place, and it was all improvised, baby. Give me a beat! 1972 playoffs, Raiders at the Steelers, down by one with 22 seconds left. Fourth down on our own 40. Hit those keys! The call was 66 circle option. Drop that base. We were making things up right from the snap, and I was scrambling. I see Frenchie Fuqua downfield, and I let her rip. Then Jack Tatum laid the hammer down. Franco Harris plucks the ball out of thin air to win the game, but I still don't know what the heck he did on that play. Improvised, I guess. Who hit the ball first? Did he catch it? I don't know. I didn't see any of it. I'm thinking, wow, perfect pass. All I know is that play launched the Steeler dynasty. And the sweet music of four Super Bowls started with Mr. Improv himself, the great Franco Harris. And if you don't know about Franco Harris, folks, well, you're about to find out who he is.
You're gonna be a football player when you grow up?
Today is the best day of your life. Believe
it. Give me 18 years of daylight. That's all right.
Greatest leader I've ever known.
What a ride it's been.
I love being a running back. Those tough games, those big games. I loved it.
So there we go. Quite a poignant story behind this. You'll notice when you see the, if you watch the film, that there's a card to Franco commemorating his life with the 2022 date that, at the end of it there. So he passed away in December time. I didn't know this until, I think it was December, maybe it was the end of November. My brother-in-law and my sister came over for Christmas time.
Okay.
And Franco's a huge, huge star in Pittsburgh, regarded by a lot of people as the best player in the best ever Pittsburgh team. They won four Super Bowls in 6 years. They were the team of the 70s. And there was a catch, which is, I think I've picked it on air before, frequently voted as the best play ever in the NFL, called the Immaculate Reception, where he picked up a rebounding ball and ran it into the end zone. And it was 50 years ago in December that happened. And that sort of, if he hadn't have done that, they would have lost that game and that dynasty may never have happened. So that's seen as the turning point from a team that were really rubbish that became really, really, really good.
But he was gutted to go to them in the draft, wasn't he?
Oh, he's devastated. If they hadn't won anything for 30, 40 years, they were hopeless. But on the back of that play, they went to the Super Bowl. Actually, I don't think they did that. I think on the back of that play, they went to the conference championship and lost that year. But they went back to the Super Bowl the year after that, and they won four of the next six Super Bowls.
I love this documentary, and he comes across so well. Mm. And we'll talk about it more, obviously. But I'm going to say something probably controversial because I don't understand the sport.
Yep.
I didn't think the play was that impressive.
That's interesting, because I felt similar.
And the catch is something I've seen rugby union players do loads.
Well, I've seen NFL players do it loads as well.
It's right by his feet, isn't it?
Well, it's bootstraps, as they say.
Yeah, but you know, it's great. But it's certainly not. It's not the Gareth try against the Barbars, is it? Which impresses me every time I see it.
I think it's more what it led to. I think if that Barbars try had been, if it had been a try for Wales, and Wales had been awful for years and years and years, and that try then turned them into the team of the 70s. It's more than it was a turning point in a team, in a franchise, and a team.
Okay.
But the point being, it was 50 years since it happened, and they were going to put, retiring Franco's number. It was the 50th anniversary of the Immaculate Reception. So what they were going to do was, they were going to paint the field the same as it was in 1972. They were going to try and make it look as authentic as they could.
Okay.
Bring Franco up before the game, big presentation to celebrate that 50 years of it. He died like the week before. He died a couple of days before.
I didn't know that.
All the preparations were in place. Everything had been advertised. It was all ready to roll. And he literally passed away, I think, about 3 or 4 days before it happened.
Gosh.
So just weird how the sports gods sometimes conspire to do weird things at weird times. But so that never happened. So this is the documentary that was, they'd already made.
Mm.
He finished recording this about a month or two before he died, I think.
Really?
Really, really sad story. But what a player. What a player.
Yeah.
When you get to Pittsburgh, which is a great city, my sister lives there, so I've only been there a couple of times. In the 70s, it was known for industry. It was known for steel. That's why they're called the Steelers, and coal. Really heavy blue-collar industry. You know, there's lots of photographs of Pittsburgh back in the day just covered in that sort of smoke and that smog and that sort of dust everywhere. Now it's just a stunning place, a beautiful city. But when you get there, the first thing you see, and they mention it in the doc, and it's true, the first thing you see is a Franco Harris statue.
That's pretty cool.
In the airport. And you get in the lift there, and there's another one of the Steelers telling you all about welcome to Pittsburgh, you know. And then you go down another level, and there's a big Pittsburgh Steelers sort of cutout where you can put your face in it. They are football mad. It is a football mad city. And he's the biggest star in a football mad city of their best ever team. So, but he just comes across such a bloody nice bloke as well, doesn't he?
That was the thing for me. Like I say, like Alice says, I didn't quite get why this is voted to be the best play in NFL history.
We got a clip in the second half that is better play than this.
Well, that's the point.
Wow.
So I don't quite understand that part. I get your explanation. But as a bloke and as a bloke's story and his clear love of pretty much everything, his teammates, the city, the history of the Jazz in the city. I was fascinated by him and his take, even like from his dad being a GI and meeting his mum in Italy and then them coming home. And I thought that element of the story was fascinating, how he wanted to be special forces when he was growing up because that's what he knew. He knew the army and he knew that side of the world. And I've never really thought about that, where if your parents were in the forces, are you naturally sort of more inclined to go towards it because that's what you know?
Yeah.
He seems to be loved because he played quite spontaneous football. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah.
Whereas now the plays are far more prescriptive. So you act upon things that you've done to death in training. Whereas he seemed to be what my dad would call a sort of head up rugby player, quite more reactive.
There's a school of thought with coaching which is called run to daylight, which is where your offensive line will make the blocks they think are the best blocks. And you're going to run between right guard and right tackle. If the gap is between left guard and left tackle, you'll go through that. So you don't just run to where the play's called, you run to daylight. So
yeah,
that line they had in Pittsburgh were great. But Franco, Christ, I mean, I didn't realise, I knew a lot about him anyway, but watching this video again and seeing some of the footage I hadn't seen before, what a runner.
Yeah.
What balance and size and fucking speed on it for a bloke that size. And he always looked, I mean, there's no shock to anybody that I love the 70s. Talk about a bloke who epitomised the 1970s.
Yeah.
When he had that.
But the good bits.
That big hair, the bloody big collars, the great looking jackets, just a cool, cool looking man.
Huge sides.
Massive sides. I'd say, As a Welsh bloke whose family are from the Welsh Valleys, what I liked about this as well, about Pittsburgh, especially at the time, there was like Franco's Italian army. So there were people who would dress up, because like I said, he was half Italian, half American, but mixed race as well. There's a real melting pot. I know it's an overused phrase, but when you live in industrial areas, so Pittsburgh was where most of the Welsh people in America first settled because of the mines and the steelworks.
Yeah,
they stopped by Steadfords until the 1930s and 1940s, you know?
Okay.
So you get Welsh coal miners and you've got a lot of Polish coal miners and you've got a lot of Italians coming over there and there's a real mix of people in Pittsburgh. Like a lot of blue collar areas get. They haven't got sort of class system we've got as such. But there seems to be less of a, I don't know, compared to some cities in America, there seems to be less of a racial thing.
Okay.
So the Franco was just seen as one of them because he was this tough nosed football player.
Yeah.
You wouldn't look at Franco and go, he looks like an Italian. Do you know what I mean?
No, absolutely. But
that was the part of his heritage that they latched onto. And they said every player, you wouldn't just have the team flags. Every player had their own group of supporters.
That's
fanatical. You know, I love that. Christ, imagine.
I saw Sinatra dressed up in Franco's army kind of stuff at one point.
Yeah.
They sort of inducted him into their supporters club.
Great, isn't it?
Like, that's really cool. If Sinatra's on your team.
And really getting the sort of, because where football's always struggled, since the 40s, right? Because of the face mask, you don't see players' faces.
Sure.
And the NFL are really keen on players, people getting a link to a player. It's much, much more easy to get enthused about a team and get behind it when the players are recognisable. So it's tough with a face mask and a helmet, and especially you've got a visor on your face mask as well. Mm. But they really got the cult of the individual with that Pittsburgh team in the 70s. The nice thing about that for me was even though there was that, all the players had their own fan clubs almost. The overriding quality that they talk about with Franco when it's his teammates, saying he was a team player.
Yeah.
He didn't care who scored the points. He didn't care who scored the touchdowns. That was irrelevant. It was about the team winning.
He was sharing points with other players in his position because they said he was just obsessed with winning. And also, he seems so community-orientated.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he's trying his best to renovate and refurb a jazz cafe that was really, really popular in the 1940s at the sort of height of jazz. Mm. And he's really passionate about it. And there's interviews a jazz band sort of who all look like they're in their 70s.
Oh, cool, those old guys.
Yeah, they look great.
Yeah.
They've been doing that for 50 years, just hanging around with each other, playing music.
He seems to be just someone who loves where he's from, but also accepts its faults and wants to improve where it is he's from.
Yeah.
Well, he's a New Jersey native, I think. He loved Pittsburgh, like Steph said at first, because the draft being what it is, and there's another reason I love the draft, which I do, they were rubbish and had been rubbish for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He hated going there. He didn't want to go there. He then goes there, turns that team around. They then become the team of the 70s, of a then 26-team league.
Yeah.
Some of those records that he set were done in 14-game seasons.
That's nice.
People forget that as well.
Yeah.
And now we're playing 17-game seasons.
Yeah. I like the bit where they were talking about the jazz club and they talked about how people would stop off in Pittsburgh because you'd get bands who were in Chicago and bands who were in New York.
Yeah, I love that.
And they'd travel in the opposite directions and they'd all stop there.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense because that's your stop-off point. And I'd never thought about how you'd sort of wind up then with a load of crossover jazz musicians, one lot going from Chicago to New York, the other lot going the other way. It'd be wicked.
Yeah.
Just have these fantastic gigs that are impromptu.
Well, the Blues Brothers is Chicago, wouldn't it?
Yes, yeah. You get just impromptu gigs where some of your favourite musicians would turn up. That must have been amazing.
But it'd be in a position where you go somewhere and you end up loving it, and you can... I know it's another phrase that's been done to death, but you do give back. He spent the last 40 years giving back to that community.
Yeah.
Never went back to Jersey, stayed in Pittsburgh. That's been a brilliant sort of community leader. And why is it up to the nice people? Why do some wankers live to be 100? And you get great people like Franco Harris. The week when it's going to be about him for once in his life, right?
Yeah.
And that team was full of luminaries, Trey Bradshaw, Mean Joe Green, Jack Lambert, Lynn Swan, right? And then this is Franco's day. Thanks, Franco. This is your day.
Yeah.
You fucking died 3 days before.
Yeah.
Oh, grim. Not grim. We've all got to shuffle off. But, I mean, it's just, I don't know.
He seems so uncomfortable in the limelight.
Yes.
And he seemed so uncomfortable receiving praise. And yet, deep down, he must know that he was something special.
Mm.
But he doesn't think he's special.
Yeah.
So he comes across, I'd never heard of him, and he's one of the most likeable subjects of a documentary we've had.
Good, I'm glad you liked him.
If I was a big football fan, he would be my guy.
Well, teammates, they're saying that, you know, if we have a problem, the first person on the phone, you might have read about it in the paper or something, Frank will pick.
Yeah.
You know, Frank was on the phone.
It was the quarterback was saying, wasn't
he? Terry Bradshaw, yeah.
That's it, yeah, yeah. He was saying that he'd been ill, and then Franco's on the phone just checking in.
Amazing.
Making sure you're all right. I love stuff like that anyway, because I like teammates who sort of, you might not phone each other for years, but you're always a mate. You're always a teammate. I kind of like that vibe.
I love watching ex-players, especially the older they are, the better it is, reminiscing about their playing careers, because he's in his early 70s. Who's the person he has the meal with, Mike?
Oh, God.
It's not Joe Hamm, is that his name?
Or? Jack Hamm.
Jack Hamm. And they go for a meal, and they're just talking about playing in the sort of late 60s, early 70s. Mm. Although, you get the similar sort of feeling when Gareth Edwards is asked about playing for Wales in the 70s. They're sort of, their eyes twinkle. Because I think occasionally, I think some people are bored about being asked the same questions. But I think others, and Franco Harris is a good example of this, has come to accept that what he did was very, very special. And this likes talking about it because that was his, you know, and there's nothing wrong with reminiscing about something you did in your 20s and 30s, especially when it's, you've given so much to a community that still inspires you. I love that. I just think it's really
well, nice. NFL films, I've banged this drum before, right? They do it so well. They really get the...
They're the best. They're the best.
They really get the nostalgia side of it. They really get the human stories of things. I won't go at length into it now, but on the back of watching this, I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. I watched another one, which I'll pick in the future, about the Dolphins team that was unbeaten in 72.
Okay, yeah.
Bloody hell. And it was just... They meet up every 5 years.
Oh, really?
But now there's less and less of them.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah.
So they've been doing it now for 50 years.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is, you know. So they're not down to a few, and then they go, "Well, listen, we know that one day, one of us will turn up, and there's no one else there."
Oof.
Well, the spirit of 58 boys.
Well, Cliff, yeah.
Jones and Terry Medwin met Gareth Bale and the rest of the squad.
Lovely.
And so I think there's another two who were in the squad but didn't get on the pitch who are still alive.
Okay.
Of the 11 who played.
Why is that not being a documentary? Yeah. Why do they do that? How fascinating would that be?
Yeah, that's true.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you just
think
NFL films just get it.
Yes.
And you haven't got to be, Kelly watches for me. She's not a football fan. She'll watch a bit of it if I'm in the room watching it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She loved it.
But it's not a football story. The best documentaries are, are they? The best documentaries are human stories. Even just looking, I was fascinated looking at his hands in some of the early shots because obviously they're huge, but obviously, he's had a professional sports career, so they're kind of a little bit mangled and a little
they're all shooting gnarled, off in
funny directions. I always love that. And then the bit where they were talking about how some people perceived him to not be what a running back should be because he found exits off the pitch. So he would run, but not necessarily into contact. And I love that because that's, well, first of all, it's clever. And I quite like that anyway. Self-preservation is quite... There's nothing tough.
Pronged his career.
It's the whole argument you have with idiots. Game's gone soft brigade in rugby, right?
Mm.
They were the sort of things that got leveled at him in certain quarters in the 70s, right? And his theory was, well, do I want to shatter my knee for an extra yard?
Yeah.
I'm our best running back.
Yes. You
know? I'm running for 100 yards a game.
Mm.
You know, I'll take a yard less here and I'll be at the next play.
Exactly. Yeah. 100%.
But people have won us.
Sense.
Yeah.
And then they showed all the situations where it was, you know, fourth and goal, where he was going through. And he was taking the contact to try and score. And you're like, well, you're not scared, are you? You're pragmatic.
Exactly, mate. Look, the dickheads who said that wouldn't last one fucking snap in the NFL.
Exactly.
Like the same idiots talking about rugby players and the game's gone soft. So go on then, mate. You have a game against Samoa and see how you get on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that first tackle when you shit your pants and walk off the field crying, right?
Yeah.
You don't know what you're talking about.
You didn't know you'd watch me play.
Do you see my dad?
These people, frankly, they just don't get it. They don't understand what it's like.
Yeah.
Is that a common thing then? to run off rather than
not then, Christ,
the concept. No. Is it? Does it happen more? Because to me, it seems a bulletproof argument.
Well, yeah, because you keep the ball in football, and you can kill the clock. So it, you know, if you're out of bounds, you get the ball back. B, you protect yourself, and C, you stop the clock. So if you're on possession, it makes more sense. But people wanted him to go inbounds and smash. You know, like Steph said, then you know those same idiots. Give them a helmet and a pair of pads. Fourth and goal from the 1 yard line. Say, run through there, then, mate.
Go on. Have a go. See how it's going to work out for you.
See what happens.
I also like the shots of him where he'd had the really big breakthrough in a preseason game, and then his first NFL game where he's like, "Oh shit, this is a totally different sport now.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's this come from?"
How refreshingly honest was that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't hear that from sports people.
No, you never.
My debut was a scary nightmare.
Yeah, fucking hell, they're good.
Yeah, they're good, they're fast, and they're
hard. Because college football is massive, and he was brilliant in college, right? And it's probably the biggest sport in America, right?
Mm.
But such a small percentage of those lads make the NFL. You're lucky if in a big program, you know, UCLA or one of the big schools, Michigan, you know, maybe a couple of those boys will make the NFL every year in the biggest colleges. So when you're playing college football and you're a superstar, you're suddenly, when you get the NFL, playing against all the superstars from all the colleges in every game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The difference in level is just, it's night and day.
Just be
scared. And certain positions, you know, there's certain things where there are maybe a bit more reactive, that maybe there's an easier slot in, but Christ, you go from running against college defenses to running against NFL defenses.
Yeah.
It isn't the same thing. One of my first memories of football, even before Channel 4, I think it was, was a Coca-Cola advert, was it, with Mean Joe Green?
Okay.
Do you remember it? Was it Joe Green? I'm sure it was Joe Green. And a little kid, you know, comes up and gives him a Coke after a game. I'm sure that happened.
Okay.
I'm sure I've made that up. But that's a really, it's a really cool team.
Yeah.
Steelers. I said, Bonnie, before, if I hadn't been a Packers fan, if I'd have been into football 10 years earlier, it would have been probably the Raiders or the Steelers, because they appeal to my, you know, what I like, that sort of blue collar. And do you know what as well? I was thinking, you're talking about his hands. It is unbelievable how cold it gets in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, I saw that Thanksgiving game there about 4 or 5 years ago now against the Packers.
Yes.
I've never been so cold in my life. And I could think, imagine trying to catch a ball in this.
Yeah.
It was 40 years, I think, since the thing called the, what did they end up calling it? Oh, God, Cincinnati were playing. I can't remember. They gave it a nickname.
Oh, it's -6 there.
Yeah. Oh, that's nothing, mate, honestly. Look at the Cincinnati game, 1982, I think it was.
Right.
Coldest NFL game ever, where with the wind chill, it was -50.
Oh, we discussed this. We watched we watched a doc about this.
-50.
You have to call a game off.
Too cold, guys. Too cold.
Come on.
Come on. No one's enjoying that.
And also, that Three River Stadium where the Steelers used to play, which is, I think it's, have they knocked it down now? Heinz Field is not far from there, anyway.
Okay.
But that was, again, the early version of AstroTurf as well. So a bit like a concrete pitch.
Yeah.
Like a concrete field, -25 degrees in the winter.
A school hockey pitch.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. No tar.
No.
Tough, tough boys. And you got all the arseholes saying, you know, so-and-so's weak or so-and-so's this. Are they? Okay. I don't think they are. There's a good chance you're talking bollocks there, mate.
Do you fucking want it? He's lacking bottle. He lacks fucking bottle. He doesn't want that, does he?
Sack them all.
He's fucking lacking bottle.
There's always some prick doing some of that, isn't there?
I reckon the 11 of us could go out there now and play better.
Yeah, yeah.
What's he doing?
Because I fucking want
What's he doing? Just fucking catch it, innit?
Catch it, run. We're running off for again.
Steelers, man. And that was, I'm trying to think of the owner. It's the Rooney, isn't it? Irish family.
Okay.
Wayne and Colleen.
What? That's them, yeah. Yeah.
That's the ones. Wayne Rooney is American football.
I
team.
Knew he was older than he said he was. He was actually 44 when he scored that goal against Arsenal.
You imagine the war, right? We talked about Dixie's Eden, that pre-war earlier. And obviously a lot of football here stopped in the war. But some got played. I didn't realise they still played games.
Mm. Yeah, regional games, yeah.
Yeah. So their version of regional games in the States was they combined teams.
Okay.
So Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. Yeah, I think it was just those two. Was there another team with them as well?
Right.
Yeah, the Phil Pitt Steelers Eagles, which became known as the Steagles, right?
It's a shit name.
It's a crap name, isn't it?
It's a shit name.
Shit name.
Come on. The war going on, you come up with a shit name team. for me.
There's another really good doc I watch about the origins of the logos and stuff, and they said that so that Steelers.
What's the logo there? Because the name, I presume, is to do with steel workers.
Right. So check this is really good. So
people nicked stuff.
They used to have a black helmet, plain black helmet, right?
Yeah.
Black and yellow, because I think that was the Steelers colours, or Pittsburgh colours, basically.
Okay.
But plain black helmet. But then they're Steelers with a double E, as in steelworks, right?
Yeah.
So steel, like British coal or whatever, American steel had that logo, because it's the three elements. I think it's fire, iron, and water, or whatever it is. However you make steel.
Okay.
So they're the three stars are the three elements of steel. And then they have the word steel in there.
Right.
So they change it to Steelers on the side. And I think they're going to get some special sort of dispensation to be able to use it off the US Steel.
That's weird.
But they weren't sure whether the fans would like it. So they only put it on the helmet on one side of the helmet.
Yes.
For a game. The first game they tried it.
Yeah.
They won the game. And then sports superstition being what it is.
Yeah.
Exactly. They thought, well, fucking don't fuck with this. We'll just keep it on one side. So they're the only team in the NFL with a logo on one side of the helmet.
That's a weird combination.
It'd be like Middlesbrough, a steel town, their football club having the badge that was like the British Steel logo.
Basically,
That's weird.
I love all that. Little quirks, though, do you know what I mean? But yeah, so Franco, I could watch NFL documentaries all day long.
And you do?
Yeah, and I do. Don't tell my wife.
when you've run out of far right ones to get through.
I've been very busy, actually, Kelly.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually.
Did you cook dinner, Mike? How am I supposed to cook dinner and watch this?
Let me tell you about Jerry Rice, Kelly.
Is it for work? It will be eventually, yes.
There will be food here.
I love it.
Sit you down and talk to you about Dan Marino instead.
Oh, don't get me started. I'll be here all day long. Yeah, so I'm really enjoying the playoffs at the moment. I know some of our listeners don't like the NFL. I love the NFL anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But these docs, if you like the NFL or don't like the NFL, it's free. It's on YouTube. But what an absolute treat as hour-long documentaries go.
Right, let's round things off for this episode. What are we on? What episode is this?
144.
144. 144.
We've completed the 12 times table.
Oh, that's as far as numbers go in my mind.
Yeah.
Numbers don't go any higher. We don't teach kids numbers beyond this.
We've done a gross of podcasts.
Gross.
Magic.
That's always the aim, is to reach.
And some people still not chipping in.
Yeah.
After 144 episodes.
It happens, man.
What a sad life.
But I can't remember. How many episodes did we do three books for? Because it's more than 144 books we'll have recommended.
Right. Yeah. I've got to tell you this. This is a great idea. One of the listeners.
What?
James Taylor, I think his name is. I think if it's not you, James, I apologise. To be honest, mate, you get more of a name check than I usually give people. Right?
Go on, what's he want?
How's this for an idea? Because I'll be honest with you, right?
Yeah.
I've read all my sports books now. That's a fact.
I've read all of them.
Yeah.
Go on.
And if I buy more ones, I will read them, but I certainly won't read them in a week. He said, which I think is a bloody great idea, why don't listeners suggest a book and maybe even write a review for a book?
Okay, I like this. I think there's something in us doing one book a month that we all read and then doing that as a separate thing.
Well, for the Patreons?
I don't know, yeah. I think that might work nicely if we did a book that we read.
Noel Gallagher's Book Club.
Noel Gallagher. He's not a man who likes reading.
I think he took the piss. I think he just, years in the 90s, said that he didn't trust people who read books or something. I think he's probably softened his attitude towards books. in recent years. But I certainly remember years ago him saying something along those lines. Noel Gallagher's Book Club and Michael Owen's Movie Club.
I reckon we've recommended... I reckon this is our 178th book recommendation.
Bloody there we go. Hell.
I think. I'm willing to be corrected on that because maths is not my strong point and Rishi is correct. We should all have more maths lessons. What I would also point out to Rishi is I have maths A-level. That's done me fuck all use.
Exactly.
Yeah. I got a B in maths A level, but I'm struggling to add up if we did three books up to episode 17 and then we're on episode 144. I'm struggling to work out what that is.
178, is it?
I think so. But I did just say that, so you might be being influenced by that.
Oh yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, that'll be it. Right, Alice, What get in touch with us actually at Distant Pod or on the Patreon WhatsApp group if you have ideas of what we can do with this book review set. Because sometimes we don't go in enough depth, I think, books. So give us some ideas of what we can do.
If you want back covers, I'm your man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yes.
In 2013, Noel Gallagher took an unexpected broadside at imaginative writing, branding the art of fiction a waste of fucking time.
Good lad. What's
I only read factual books. I can't think of... I mean, novels are just a waste of fucking time, Gallagher told the writer Danny Wallace in an interview to Marcus, becoming GQ magazine's icon of the year. I can't suspend belief in reality. I just end up thinking, this isn't fucking true.
But that's all of his songs.
The guitarist, the songwriter...
Exactly, every single song.
Went on to explain how he preferred reading about things that actually happened, citing Ernest R. May's depiction of the White House during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Kennedy tapes, as the kind of book he can get into. I'm reading this book at the moment thinking, wow, this actually fucking happened. They came that close to blowing the world up.
Yeah.
So
I was just talking to my friend about it, who actually is electric.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And has a family full of eccentrics. Fact.
Gallagher, the driving force behind the band Oasis during the 1990s, the literary industry is bound up with issues of class, arguing that people who write and read and review books are fucking putting themselves a tiny little bit above the rest of us who fucking make records and write pathetic little songs for a living. According to the booksellers, Kathy Retzenbrink, Gallagher's identified an incredibly serious point. He's saying what loads of people in this country think, but don't normally have a platform to say, Retzenbrink added.
They're too thick.
Vast amounts of people feel this way do feel that people who are comfortable with words look down on them.
Well, so they should.
This isn't necessarily a problem for the books industry.
That's what looking down's for.
With a third of adults
who else never, look down on?
Never reading for pleasure, and one in six adults have literacy problems, it's a problem for the country.
It's not a little.
It's a problem for fucking lazy people who don't read.
But so why imagine read. Just ruling out fiction?
Or reading. No, the problem is...
This is going to sound awful.
People who can read look down their nose, people who can't read. Yes, they do.
For the last 10 years, I've read almost no fiction, and I've just read no Gallagher
stuff. Since you read that interview, you've read no fiction.
I've read nothing but Graham Hancock books for the last 5 years.
I read politics and history and sport. That's all I really read. Reading a great book about Putin at the moment.
Putin, is that your choice for episode 144?
No, but I'm not gonna recommend.
What's it called?
I'll fetch it for you now.
Last novel I read was called The Guns of the South.
What was?
Last novel I read. Guns of the South by Harry Turtledove, yeah.
Okay.
Really good. We're making a part of the house into a little reading area where we can just sit and read a book. Kelly's idea.
Really? Quite like
the
that.
The Age of the Strong Man, How the Cult of the Leader Threatens Democracy Around the World by Gideon Rachman is a book I'm enjoying at the moment.
Nice.
A book I expect to enjoy is a book that should arrive today.
Okay.
To an email I've just read.
Right.
It is the authorised biography of Ivor Allchurch.
Oh, nice.
By Peter Stead, Barry Boy, historian, and David Farmer, who wrote History of the Swans. And I was prompted to read this because I bumped into someone who I'm hoping listens to this show on the Tube in London on last Saturday, and he told me his Ivor Allchurch story, where he'd gone to watch Ivor play in a charity game in Pencoed, I think, and he really, really wanted to meet him, and he was a little kid, and there was a massive queue, and all the bigger kids were pushing in front of him, and because they were all trying to get Ivor's autograph. And it was a glittering array of people playing in this charity football match. Some rugby players, I think Gareth Edwards was playing. I think he said that. And eventually his dad said, listen, we're not going to get his autograph. He's too busy. And Ivor said, no, I've seen him. I'll give him an autograph. And he was only a little kid. And he said, that is my, I've seen him play. I can say I've seen him play. And I can say that there was a tiny little act of kindness. And I've got his autograph, which I've still got in the house. But I'm afraid I don't remember this person's name. But I thought, I'm going to buy a biography or an autobiography of Ivor Allchurch. And it came out in 1998. And he was some player. Santiago Bernabeu, who was the chairman of Real Madrid in the 50s, which is obviously the ground they
played. I was going to say, he's named after the stadium.
Yeah. After the 58 World Cup, he described Allchurch as the best inside forward in world football.
Fucking hell.
So he was some player. He was really, he's in the English Hall Football Hall of Fame, and he was known as the golden boy of Welsh football. So he was at the Swans, And it looked, that 50s Swansea team looked like they were going to get promoted to the first division for the first time. But they would fall, they were playing an attractive brand of football, but they would fall at the final hurdle. And eventually the club weren't investing in the team and he decided to go to Newcastle. And he wanted to stay at Swansea because he loved the area. He was a Swansea boy and he didn't really want to move away. But he was able to earn, after they got rid of the maximum wage, £60 a week, which was huge. But he's a real legend up in Newcastle. And then he came back to Cardiff and then ended his career at the Swans. He relegated the Swans with a hat-trick in the South Wales Derby. But until Ian Rush broke his record, he held the record for most goals scored by a Welsh player. He shared it with Trevor Ford, in fact. He scored 23 goals for his country, 68 caps, played in one of our greatest ever teams. You know, there's a statue of him outside the Liberty for a reason. He was a really, really fantastic footballer. I think it probably would be between him and Ramsey, actually, for that position in an all-time Welsh 11.
That is a horrible call for you to make.
Yeah, it's one I'm really struggling with. I think about it quite a lot.
What does inside forward mean?
You nowadays.
What's that, midfield?
You'd be sort of the deeper striker.
Okay.
So you were sort of, you did score goals, but you were often sort of killer passes for your number nine. You'd be playing sort of deep in the hole, I suppose, is how you would describe it nowadays. It's not really a position that exists anymore. A bit more of a sort of string puller, like a sort of cross between a striker and an attacking midfielder. But he was some player. The volley scores against Hungary, I think, in the 1958 World Cup, which is easy to find on YouTube, is fantastic. And when you consider the kind of ball they were playing with as well, is even more impressive. So I am about to read Ivor Allchurch, MBE, the authorised biography, which came out in 1998.